Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Jerry Ahern's The Survivalist. Narrated by Terrence Aselford, with performances by Mort Shelby, Nanette Savard, M.B. Van Dorn, Dylan Lynch, Eric Messner, Michael Glenn, Ren Casey, Jeff Baker, David Coyne, Elizabeth Demery, Stephen Carpenter, Thomas Penny, Michael John Casey, Colleen Delaney, Johan Detweiler, Elizabeth Jernigan, and Ken Jackson. Survivalist number 21, to end all war. Fiery fingers hissed above the high mountain plateau, groping into the icy darkness. Cadaverous hulks of twisted steel and titanium alloys lay at the base of each towering plume of flame, glowing bright in the burning synth fuel that moments earlier powered the mighty Soviet war machines. The Russian armor, like once fearsome prehistoric beasts, lay dismembered, sprawled, and inert. For a moment, John Rourke remembered Natalia's uncle, Ishmael Varakov, commanding general of the Soviet North American Army of Occupation. His office, without walls, stood in the Chicago Museum near reconstructed skeletons of two massive beasts. The fires before John formed a seemingly impenetrable wall, a flickering yellow-orange artificial horizon. They surrounded John Rourke, Michael Rourke, and Paul Rubinstein. Thick trails of blue smoke swept over the snow-packed rock and debris-strewn landscape on heat-fed, frigid winds. In every direction, bits of wreckage, ranging in size from the minute to the immense, burned. Nearly all that remained now of the armada of T-91 tanks, armored personnel carriers, and the battleship-sized mobile missile-launching platforms were glowing skeletons. John moved his right hand. It hurt badly from the burns he sustained from the live steam. He thrust it back into a side pocket of his parka, and he was cold, colder than he could ever remember. Rourke burned his way through the gunner's dome of a Soviet missile launching platform. The flames nearly devoured him. The flames burned away large portions of his Arctic gear, despite the clothing's fire-retardant protection. But the drifts he plunged into as he cleared the huge machine before it rolled over the edge of the Great Plateau extinguished the flames. The out-of-control missile platform rolled and tumbled, destroying itself as it plummeted through the abyss. Rourke burrowed into the snow to save himself from incineration, obtaining what protection he could as the other enemy machines around him exploded, targeted by the missiles from the mobile launcher he escaped. As the snow melted into icy water, it drenched the linings of his parka and snow pants, saturating his Arctic gear, the sweater, and battle dress utilities beneath. He was soaked and shivered almost uncontrollably. Each passing second chilled the dampness into ice. His body temperature kept dropping. Rourke's medical training and his common sense told him he must find shelter, must strip off his freezing garments before hypothermia set in hard enough to kill. Rourke reached for the energy weapon, but Paul already held it.
Come on!
Rourke oriented himself, then broke into a jog trot toward the German armored vehicle he dubbed Atsak. The massive machine sat barely visible against the snowfield as an odd-shaped mound. The synth fuel fires burned dangerously close to it. Paul and Michael fell into a jog through the snow on either side of John.
Michael! Did you turn the systems back on?
If not, the Atsak would only be a windbreak, but otherwise nearly as cold as the natural environment surrounding them.
Everything's up and ready! And with enough speed up, we can roll through those fires without burning the treads!
The double exertion of running and shivering was beginning to tax Rourke's strength, already depleted as a result of the battle to take control of the Soviet missile platform and capture the energy weapon. As they neared the mounded snow, the outline of the Atsak took on greater definition. The full-tread, all-terrain vehicle was smaller than a single-story house, the wedge-shaped titanium plow taller than any man, reminiscent of the cowcatchers on the 19th-century steam locomotives that once plied the western frontier. Rourke pulled his right hand from his pocket, using it more for balance than for anything else. Most of his right glove burned away in any event. To touch the bare metal of the vehicle would cost him more skin. He climbed up the tread and toward the portside ladder, shuffling snow from the rungs as he moved, and gingerly sliding his flame-burned left hand along the vertical stanchion. He reached the height of the ETSEC superstructure, tugged at the hatch, and threw it back. Desperation and exhaustion drove him, powered him. Paul and Michael, navigating the Soviet energy weapon between them as they climbed, were just below him, mounting the superstructure. The energy weapon was about the size of a pre-war M60 machine gun, and about the same weight. Paul had it now as Rourke started down through the hatchway into the environmentally sealed antechamber. Michael slid down the ladder's verticals, jumping to the floor just behind Rourke. Paul passed down the energy weapon to Michael, then followed down the ladder. As Paul passed beyond the hatch, he slung it back. Rourke hit the powered locking unit controls and the hatch sealed. Then John activated the air scrubbers. Air, it seemed cold despite its warmth, flooded the compartment. Rourke swallowed to equalize the mounting pressure in his ears. Finally, the green light flashed on. Rourke activated the interior hatch controls. John Rourke moved down and through, the comparative warmth suffocating to him. He dropped the rest of the way down the ladder and into the ATSAC's ready room. John crossed out of the way of the ladder base, unbuckled the black leather gun belt at his waist, snaked it, together with the .44 Magnum revolver and LS-10 survival fighting knife, and dropped it on the surface of a bulkhead-mounted three-man-wide seat. Rourke dropped to his knees, clumsily stripping his Arctic parka from his body with his burned hands. With his left hand, he drew first one, then the other of his scoremasters from his trouser band, setting the gleaming stainless steel .45s beside his gun belt. His sweater, like a pre-war woolly pulley, was heavy with half-frozen water. John tore away the snow goggles that hung around his neck, then pulled off the toque that covered his head and threw it down. And at last, he removed his sweater. He tugged the little Smith & Wesson 9mm with the suppressor and slide lock free of his clothes, placing the pistol on the seat. Paul jumped the last few rungs, skinning out of his parka and goggles, still wearing his toque and snow pants. He bit off his outer gloves, grabbing down the self-heating, thermal-insulated blankets from the racks on the opposite bulkhead.
We'll have you warm in a hurry, John.
Rourke struggled with his bootlaces.
Oh, the hell with it.
John drew the little A.G. Russell Sting 1A black chrome from its sheath just inside the waistband of his trousers. He ran one edge along the expendable laces of his boots, severing them rather than untying them. He put the knife down beside the other weapons as he kicked free of his boots. With his left hand, he tore open the burn-tattered snow pants. His BDUs beneath them were soaked in melted snow. Rourke pushed the snow pants down, then the BDUs, before he dropped to the floor in his underpants. Michael knelt down beside his father, grabbed the snow pants by the bottoms of the legs, and pulled.
When you were a kid, Michael, I'd undress you for bed sometimes. Never quite this hurriedly.
Michael started on the BDU pants as Paul took the double Alessi shoulder rig from Rourke's body, then helped his friend's progressively shakier fingers with the buttons at the top of his black knit shirt. Rourke tugged the shirt up and off. Paul threw one of the blankets around the man's shoulders and back, rubbing him with it to dry him, to warm him. The blanket used natural electric currents within the body to power its heating elements, an electric blanket that never needed plugging in. Michael pulled off Rourke's socks, took up a second blanket and threw it over his father's legs and wrapped it around them.
A microwave coffee.
Michael stripped away his parka and left the ready room. Paul changed the blankets on Rourke's upper body, wrapping another one tightly around his friend.
Keep that closed. How you doing?
Freezing. I'm just fine.
The younger man only nodded as he massaged Rourke's legs and feet.
Any numbness?
No. I'm just so...
Rourke's concentration was going. He only wanted to sleep. It was as if Paul understood the imminent danger.
Yeah, no sleep until we get some warm fluids into you, right?
John barely nodded.
Yeah. Right.
Paul changed the blanket on Rourke's legs.
Hey, Michael, give me a hand here.
Rourke fought to keep his eyes open, exhausted from shivering. Then Michael and Paul were on either side of him, chairlifting in between them, holding the blankets around him. Michael ducked John Rourke's head as they crossed through the bulkhead door into the ATSAC's main compartment. They placed him on one of the lower fold-out crew bunks, wrapping the blankets tightly around him. Already, the blankets were starting to heat up. Paul elevated Rourke's head, while Michael held the cup of coffee to his father's lips.
It's hot, but not too hot to drink.
Rourke tried to nod. He sipped the coffee, letting it wash down his throat, feeling it burning inside him.
And drink it all, and then sleep.
Rourke drank more of the coffee, thinking maybe then they'd let him close his eyes. The blankets were warm now, and even though he was still shaking with the cold, he told himself everything would be all right, if only they'd let him sleep. Some called it a sixth sense. Natalia Anastasia Timarovna, Major, Committee for State Security of the Soviet, retired, didn't know what it was called. But in times like these, she had it. And when in the past she ignored it, she narrowly lived to regret it. Annie signaled a stop.
I've got to adjust this strap.
Natalia nodded, easing down her half of the improvised travoy they made to support the likely dying German officer they rescued. The man and his gutted helicopter served as bait to draw her and the other women out of the retreat into the hands of Friedrich Rausch, the brother of Damien Rausch. Sarah killed Damien as he attempted to assassinate Akira Kuranami. The neo-Nazi personnel waiting for Annie and Natalia, sucking them into a trap with the plaintive messages from a dying aviator, were almost too easy to kill.
None of them were Friedrich Rausch. He would not have been easy to kill. He got away from John.
So, where was Rausch? The answer she realized as she adjusted her parka hood against the snow and wind roaring over the lonely road leading to the retreat was that Friedrich Rausch was watching them. The Rausch dilemma was clear. If, with Annie helping her, they brought the critically injured young German officer back to the retreat, Rausch would at last know the retreat's precise location and, worse yet, the location of its primary entrance. If they did not bring the men inside, the young helicopter pilot would die. If they waited outside, they would eventually die as well. As a matter of course, she and Annie brought emergency rations, a good supply of ammunition, and were dressed for temperatures even lower than what they now experienced. They could survive several days, especially if they erected a shelter or found some natural rock formation to serve as a windbreak. But what then?
You're worried.
You're right. Are you reading me?
Right now, anybody could read your mind, Natalia.
Natalia rubbed her gloved hands together.
He is our problem. This poor man. I think we are being observed by more of the Nazis. Perhaps Friedrich Rausch himself.
I felt someone watching us. But we can't let him die.
She gestured to the young man on the travoy. Natalia nodded. John always triumphed through reasoned daring.
Are you up to a climb?
Annie pulled down her snow goggles.
What do you mean?
I have an idea.
Natalia dropped to her knees in the snow. Checking the young man for a pulse, she found one, but barely. Were he dead, their options grew, but human life was of more concern to Natalia than expediency. As she stood, she caught up her piece of harness on the travoy. Annie repositioned her goggles and did the same.
We have to hurry.
Natalia and Annie pulled their scarves closer and hauled on the harness again. The road leading to the retreat never seemed as steep to Natalia as it did now, nor as long. The wind chill was something she could only guess, but it had definitely dropped since they left the warmth of the Rourke's retreat to trace the mysterious radio message. Sarah and Maria Leuden, Michael Rourke's lover, would be anxious for them now. The rescue mission was taking much longer than expected.
Am I gambling too much? If I lose, not only do I lose the retreat, but all the lives within.
Hugo Girdler rubbed his double-gloved, nonetheless cold hands together. The rocks behind which he and Friedrich Rausch now hid served as a moderately effective windbreak, but not effective enough. He was chilled to the bone. Rausch held infrared binoculars to his eyes, peering down over the lower portion of the rock wall toward the road across the wide chasm and somewhat below them. Along the road, the two women who defeated Rausch's team of men still moved, towing after them a litter bearing the body of the helicopter pilot Rausch used as bait to draw the women out.
Soon, Girdler! They will have to enter the mountain hideaway soon. Then, we have them!
Girdler was reasonably convinced the women would have been a better choice to aid him in achieving his goals, better than Rausch and his bully boys.
And what then? After we have them, Friedrich?
Rausch did not shift his gaze.
I have the explosives ready with which to blast our way inside. Then I will summon the remainder of my force. We detonate, invade the facility, and Rourke's wife will die. His daughter and the other two women will be held hostage for Rourke cooperation in our plans. Success!
Yeah! It all sounds so easy.
Natalia stood guard at the outer retreat door until Sarah and Maria helped Annie get the near-dead pilot inside. Natalia abandoned the closed door and raced through the red-lit chamber between the outer and inner doors, then through the vault-like inner doorway. Annie and Sarah hauled the inner door closed, securing the locking system. Natalia tugged off her gloves, pushed down her hood, and unwound her headscarves as she went to the electronics console. John recently upgraded the external security system for the retreat with state-of-the-art German technology. Before she even sat down, Natalia summoned up on the various closed circuit screens vision-intensified images of the area immediately surrounding the retreat. She stripped off her gun belt that held the two L-frame Smith & Wessons, opened her parka, and undid the bib front of her snow pants, letting them fall to her waist. As Natalia shifted from one video source to the next on the main screen, she picked up movement, then changed video sources for the secondary and tertiary screens. She manipulated direction controls on the three cameras trained on the same spot.
Come here, Annie!
While Natalia checked their situation, Sarah and Maria worked to save the young pilot's life. In a moment, Annie was behind her, looking over her shoulder. Natalia glanced at her, then turned away.
Those two men. They were watching us, of course, and from their vantage point, they could certainly see the retreat entrance. I doubt they could tell there's the inner door, but even so, we're compromised.
I'm ready when you are.
Natalia nodded.
He'll use explosives, if that's Friedrich Rausch. And I'm sure it is. Explosives and a backup team, but this time, his good people, not the ones he sent against us before. Get one of your father's sniper rifles for me. Ammunition for it. Take some grenades.
And rope.
Yes, plenty of rope.
Annie and Natalia left the great room, entering the principal storage room, although there were other storage areas within and below the retreat. Here, even greater quantities of ammunition than before were stored, because John recently restocked with fresh supplies fabricated for him by the Germans. John always, ever since Natalia first met him, displayed a marked preference for one brand of ammunition and only one, that from Federal Cartridge Company. Now, he had so successfully induced the engineers of New Germany to duplicate the federal loads for his firearms, 185 grain JHP for 45 ACP, 180 grain JHP for 44 Magnum, 115 grain JHP for those few chores he deemed best served by a 9mm, etc., that the Germans even reproduced the familiar red and white boxes to the last detail. In addition to the ammunition, of course, there was a wealth of material. There were crates of everything, from feminine hygiene necessities to synthetic motor oil, to dehydrated freeze-dried foods, holsters, gas masks and bags, gas mask filters, state-of-the-art German cold weather gear, German chemical, biological, radiological protective suits, cleaning supplies for everything from kitchen countertops to firearms, spare parts, hoses, and belts for every piece of motorized equipment in the retreat, from the hydroelectric generators that powered it to the videotape machines. Replacements for items that could not be readily repaired were held in storage, ready to be brought online. Natalia wondered what John was getting ready for. She looked toward Annie. The two of them crossed the room, set down their Arctic parkas, and put their combined weight and strength against the high-rise metal tool cabinet. It moved aside over the stone floor, barely. Behind the tool cabinet was a steel door, 3 feet square. A combination lock secured it. Natalia deferred to Annie. She put her hand to the dial and turned it right, then left, then right. She put her left hand to the handle, twisted, and the door swung open. Natalia shouldered into her coat, picked up the Steyr-Mannlicher SSG, and leaned it against the wall. Then she fetched a large metal toolbox, placed it under the door, stepped up on it, and pulled herself into the crawl space of the exit tunnel, a mini flashlight clamped in her teeth. She smiled, realizing she'd just applied lipstick and would leave it on the tube of the flashlight. Annie passed up the SSG and musette bag of ammunition.
I'm with you.
She crawled toward the first rung, the rungs anchored into the living granite 3 feet apart from one another. The diffused light behind her suddenly died as Annie slammed the door shut. Natalia turned her head, aiming the flashlight in her teeth toward her friend's right hand as Annie moved the interior combination dial, locking the door. Natalia looked ahead and up. The tunnel angled steeply toward the summit of the mountain. The two women climbed. The solitary beam of light from the flashlight Natalia held clamped between her teeth swayed left and right as she alternated hands and feet on the evenly spaced rungs. At last, weary of the weight of the rifle and her other weapons, warm in the heavy German Arctic gear, Natalia reached the second door. Minus a combination lock, it was otherwise identical to the door in the retreat wall covered by the high-rise tool cabinet. A sturdy steel bar spanned the door. Both the door and the frame around it included heavy synth rubber gaskets, newly replaced when John went through the retreat replacing anything that could possibly be wearing out or deteriorating. She balanced herself on the rungs, pushing harder, finally dislodging the deadweight metal bar. The door was harder to dislodge. The seal between the rubber gaskets held strong. But at last, she was able to wrench it open. Beyond, in the beam of her flashlight, she saw more of the rising tunnel, the rungs 3 feet apart. She pushed her way through the doorway and began to climb, looking back once. In the wavering light, she could see Annie struggling through the opening in her heavy clothes with her burdens. Annie closed the door and followed Natalia up the shaft. At last, Natalia stopped at the third door. Like the intermediate door, it was only sealed with a bar and surrounded by heavy synth rubber gaskets. But surrounding the doorway were wires, all connected to a plastic and metal unit roughly the size of a package of cigarettes. John placed a new alarm on the outermost door. Routinely, rather than bothering Sarah and Maria below, Natalia disabled the high-tech unit, then used her muscle power against the bar. It moved. She shifted it aside. With Annie close beside her, Natalia wrenched open the door. She was greeted by a face full of icy cold snow. Michael drove the ATSAC while his father slept from a mild sedative cocktail. Paul and Michael bandaged John's hands after treating them with some of the new ointment from the doctors at Midwake. The healing agent proved more powerful, although less conveniently administered and non-antiseptic, than the German spray they carried as part of their standard equipment. With John sleeping and Michael piloting the ATSAC, Paul Rubinstein set to writing in his journal.
We have just done what, under normal circumstances, viewed objectively, I would have considered impossible. Again. For a time, I thought we surely wouldn't make it. Never again would I be with my wife, John's daughter, Annie. Times like these, when there is quiet and no imminent danger, are the times I miss her the most. Times when I can think. We now have an all but operational sample of the Soviet particle beam energy weapon. Coupled with the plans brought to us by the KGB Elite Corps officer Vasily Prokopyev, we should have the means by which to duplicate this awesome and awful weapon. I have mixed feelings concerning that. His introduction of a brand new weapon of wholesale slaughter to mankind's ultimate advantage? Of course not. But we have no choice. The Russians of the underground city, once they unite with their counterparts beneath the sea, the historic enemies of Midwake these past 5 centuries, will have nuclear capabilities and platforms from which to launch the enormous Soviet island-class submarines. To prevent ourselves from being overrun or being forced to use the still experimental nuclear weapons the Germans are building to counter the Russian threat, we must achieve parity on the battlefield and turn that parity to superiority. Why did Nikolai Antonovich, the commander of the combined armies of the underground city and the forces that served under Karamazov, dispatch Prokofiev to us in the first place? He trusted the young officer. Indeed, Prokofiev himself proved an honorable man, who probably sealed his fate at the same time when he assisted us at the battle for the second Chinese city. Vasily helped us neutralize the nuclear warhead missile the denizens of Second City were about to launch as part of some religious ritual. That still terrifies me to think about it. But why? Antonovich must realize the planet cannot endure a second thermonuclear confrontation. Superiors in the hierarchy of the underground city either do not realize that or disregard it. He values the fate of humankind above ambition. Bless him. I feel that very soon this seemingly endless battle will conclude, one way or the other. Annie and I decided to wait before having children. I sometimes worry very much for the child John and Sarah expect. Will the child die before birth, in a final war? Or will the child be born to a world of peace and freedom? I hope the latter proves true, and that soon after it, the first child, Annie and me, will join it in that new world. But the threat of what lies before us is so great that too often, peacetime is beyond my imagining. How, if that world comes, will I support my wife? I was a young editor in a trade magazine before the night of the war. The very night I met John Walk. I have lived many lifetimes of danger since then. Could I return to electronics, writing, or any normal occupation in this new world? Would I die instead of boredom? Well, at least Annie and I will be together. In death, in life, in whatever the future holds. Despite all my regrets, lost friends and family, and places I held dear destroyed in the bombings the night of the war and in the great conflagration, when the atmosphere caught fire and nearly destroyed all life, some things I will never regret. The love between Annie and me, my friendship with Michael Rourke, with Natalia, with Sarah, all the others, and most especially my eternal bond with John Thomas Rourke. These I cherish. I know John well enough to understand and forgive his solitary weakness, yet never so well that I do not marvel at his strengths. His weakness is his perfection. He is more than other men, and he pays the price for that. He is my friend. There could be no greater honor than that.
Paul looked up from his journal and stared at the ATSAC's bulkhead wall. After a time, he shifted his gaze, focusing on the sleeping form of John Rourke. High forehead, but naturally so, a full shock of dark brown hair just touched with gray, both a face and physique that were, at the least, imposing.
You should be the last one down, because you're the best shot.
Annie and Natalia perched atop the mountain, her father's mountain.
That way! You can cover me with Daddy's rifle.
Natalia looked at her, saying nothing for a moment, then nodding.
All right, but...
Annie smiled beneath the scarves that swathed her face, within the snorkel hood of the German Arctic parka.
But be careful.
Something like that, Annie.
Annie Rourke Rubinstein tied onto the rope, weaving it to the figure-eight descender on the Swiss seat-style rappelling harness she wore. She checked the harness where it met the D-rings, tugging at it in every conceivable direction. After her father awakened from the sleep, he spent 5 years with Annie and her older brother by 2 years, Michael, educating them in survival. Rappelling was one of the things she never liked but was forced to learn, and learn well. As she started toward the edge of the small flat expanse at the summit, Annie remembered those days.
Why do I have to learn something like rappelling, Daddy? I'm a girl!
You know, not long ago, being a girl meant you weren't taught to read and write. You weren't allowed to vote in an election. In some areas, you weren't even allowed to own property. Being born a girl meant that you were property. But let me ask you something.
What?
Her father smiled, a little embarrassed.
Aside from peeing standing up without getting his legs wet, what can a boy do that you can't?
Daddy!
Men have great upper body strength, but women have a greater threshold of pain. And even though they're more sensitive to temperature variances, women can withstand greater temperature extremes. Women tend to be more verbal, while men tend to be more analytical. Yet that didn't seem to hamper great female scientists such as Marie Curie, or great female philosophers such as Ayn Rand, did it?
No.
So just because you're a girl now, and someday you'll be a grown woman, doesn't mean you can't learn anything, do anything, or accomplish anything a boy can do.
She thought about that for a moment, then looked at him and nodded.
So get your little butt over to that rope and shout down to your brother to belay it before you start down.
She did just that. Annie got her little butt over to the rope and locked on.
Ready!
After a lot of embarrassing failures, Annie got pretty good at it. As good as her brother, as a matter of fact. In those days, she learned that if her father was going to take the time to teach her something, it was because he knew she could excel at it if she tried. Her father was not now and never was a man to waste time on useless endeavors.
Keep me covered, Natalia!
Annie jumped, controlling her descent, halting it, both feet going against the rock wall, kicking out, then descending again. If the Nazis under this Friedrich Rausch were watching this near side of the mountain rather than the main entrance to the retreat, she might very likely be dead before she reached the base. Again, she kicked off, gliding downward. Slung to her back was an M16. Belted around her waist were her two usual handguns, the Detonic Scoremaster 45 and the Beretta 92F. But there was also a third gun this time, a fixed-sight Taurus 9mm 92AF, cosmetically almost identical to the Beretta, but with three major differences. The Taurus safety system allowed its user to carry the gun cocked and locked or hammer down. It was satin chromed. Anchored beneath the forward portion of the frame was a laser aim LAI. Zeroed to the weapon on which it was mounted, it might prove valuable in the darkness. That was why she took it from the arms lockers. The Taurus was loose in one of the several musette bags slung across her torso, shoulder to hip. Again, Annie kicked out, continued to descend. Snow swirled around her. The winds near the base of the mountain blew even stronger. She was cold, oh, so cold.
All right, everybody. It's cold, but the sooner this is over, the sooner I can take a hot shower, wash my hair, slip into a gown, and move.
Despite all the training, rappelling still mildly terrified her, and Annie realized that was one of the reasons she was cold now. She kicked off again, descending more slowly as she neared the base of the mountain. She sank chest deep into a drift, then sagged back, hauling on the rope and pulling her way along the base of the mountain through the drift, at last breaking free of it and sinking to her knees. There was no sign of the enemy. She freed herself of the rope, gave it three rapid tugs, waited a second, then tugged three times again. Under different circumstances, she would have belayed the lines to ease Natalia's descent, but under different circumstances, Annie wouldn't have been rappelling down the side of the mountain in the first place. Covering Natalia's descent was more important. For that purpose, Annie pulled the laser-sighted Taurus semi-automatic from the musette bag. Its 15-round magazines were not interchangeable with those of the Beretta, although her father once told her they could be altered for that purpose. Annie tugged down her snorkel hood a little, pushed down the scarf covering her mouth, and bit off the outer glove on her right hand. With only the silk glove liner beneath, she had nearly full tactile abilities. She linked the two plugs connecting the battery-operated laser tube to the control switch. Had she done so earlier, she would needlessly have depleted the reserve. At best, she had about 32 minutes of use before recharging. 32 minutes could be enough time for hundreds of shots, because the laser only bled power when the switch activated. But as her father taught her, plan ahead. The coupling complete, Annie press-checked the Taurus, edging the slide back just enough to visually confirm a chambered round, never trusting memory or indicators or anything other than her own senses. A cartridge rested snug in the Taurus chamber, giving her 16 rounds ready. She tested the laser with a brief flash on the snowdrift near her, its red dot almost comfortingly warm to her. Then she eased her second finger against the pressure-sensitive switch. Annie moved ahead along the base of the mountain, searching for a position of concealment and cover from which she could simultaneously protect Natalia and herself. She found a niche of rock and moved into it, letting the snow bury her to the waist. With her snow smock covering the Arctic parka, she should be all but invisible, she hoped, and the rocks would provide cover from enemy fire from three sides. She crouched there, a loose grip on the laser-sighted Taurus 9mm, her eyes straining for a glimpse of Natalia descending along the rock face. Natalia Anastasia Temerovna, both a Steyr Mannlicher SSG and an M16 riding on her back from cross-body slings, descended rapidly along the mountainside. Through her goggles, she scanned below, trying to penetrate the swirling snow. There were no sounds of gunfire, nothing to indicate Annie had been detected in her descent moments earlier. In the days before the night of the war and after, when she worked actively in the KGB, there were always jokes about the so-called talented amateurs of popular fiction. But Annie, although it was hard to ever consider her an amateur, was truly that. Natalia would stake her life on Annie's courage and skills as willingly as on one of the talents of the most highly trained professional in the KGB, the Mossad, the British SIS, the American CIA, or any other organization. Annie had her father's intuitiveness for doing just the right thing at just the right time, along with a lateral approach to head-on confrontation. Annie Rourke Rubinstein was the ideal agent or officer, though she'd never been one. Emotional, open, feminine, none of these qualities interfered whatsoever with Annie's abilities to tackle the job at hand and emerge victorious. In fact, her attributes served to enhance her abilities. Natalia kicked away, controlling her descent, her right hand ready to leave the rope and grab for one of the twin L-frame Smith & Wesson revolvers holstered at her right hip. She thought about the guns for the first time in a long time. They were a gift from revolversmith Ron Mahovsky, to the man who succeeded to the presidency of the United States. President Chambers awarded them to her after the collaborative effort between United States and Soviet personnel to evacuate peninsular Florida. He told her that as an American president, he could not award a medal, even had he access to one, to an enemy agent. He gave her the revolvers instead. The barrels were flattened along the sides. The right side of each bore an engraved American eagle. She'd used them for steady carry in the field ever after that, parked in the holsters that accompanied them, on a belt John found to fit her narrow waist. She kicked off, sure to reach the ground soon. There was still no sign of fighting below. From her vantage point, when she craned her neck just so, Annie could see the rock in front of the retreat entrance that had to be moved in order to open the outer door. Beside the door, oblivious to the possibility, fact, that surveillance cameras could be monitoring their every move, two men worked. In the distance, when there was a moment's lull in the icy north wind, she heard the soft whisper of silenced rotor blades, a German gunship. Annie did not delude herself. Help was not forthcoming. If the Nazis stole one gunship and its pilot to serve their nefarious ends, they could just as easily steal two or three. Coming through the night would be Nazi reinforcements. The two men beside the rock seemed to be doing something other than lurking about. She saw a metal cylinder that could be an explosive charge, likely was. Annie bit her lower lip beneath the scarf that protected her mouth from the snow and the cold. The gunship probably carried missiles. Certainly, the missiles coupled with an explosive charge could penetrate through the outer door. The interior vault door was another matter, built of heavy gauge steel. But an explosive charge, a second one, might damage it enough to gain entry.
Damn it!
Rausch, most certainly one of the men on the ground, could have given compass coordinates to his men aboard the chopper, but most likely was bringing them in by transponder or merely by radio. If she could kill Rausch and the man with him, whoever he might be, Annie might be able to confuse the helicopter into landing either farther away or off the road entirely, crashing. In either event, she must keep the retreat entrance a secret from the Nazis. Otherwise, whatever she did to Rausch and the man with him would only be a temporary respite. Seconds remained. She glanced once toward the face of the mountain. Natalia was visible as a shadow within a swirl of snow, still some 30 or 45 seconds from touching down. There was no time to wait. Annie left the cover and concealment of the rocks, moving forward, all but swimming through the deeply drifted snow, keeping the muzzle of the laser-sighted Taurus above it. No worry about the M16, its muzzle cap in place. Again, she remembered the words of her father during those 5 years he so intensely educated and trained them.
What do you call this thing on the muzzle of my CAR-15 again?
A muzzle cap?
Now look at this.
They stood in the main supply room. Her father took down a rather large box, opened it, and turned it at an angle so that when she stood on her tiptoes, she could look inside. The box was full to the brim with more of the muzzle caps that fit tight over the flash hider, and she already knew blocked entry of dirt, water, or other foreign material through the muzzle end of the barrel.
What do you see?
A whole bunch of them?
Right. So whenever you need to protect the bore of your weapon, use one of these. But whenever you might need a shot very fast, don't worry about shooting through it because I've got enough to last us for a very long time. Okay, Annie?
Okay.
The M16's chamber was loaded. All she needed to do, if the pistol proved insufficient for the task, was swing the assault rifle forward, flick the tumbler from safe to auto, and pull the trigger. She carried an extra muzzle cap in the same bag that she carried spare magazines for the M16. As Natalia kicked away from the rock wall, there was a lull in the wind. She heard the unmistakable sound of a silenced German helicopter gunship in the night. She quickly concluded this gunship intended to reinforce Friedrich Rausch in his assault against the retreat's main entrance. Natalia let herself descend more rapidly than was wise, nearly more rapidly than was prudent, toward the drifted over ground below. Annie crouched as close as she dared without being detected. She checked the laser again, shining it into the snow. Her father taught her many things, some of which she recalled tonight. One thing he told her in those 5 years when, for all they knew, the lives in the retreat were the only lives on Earth, she remembered now.
If you ever need to take a human life, and God only knows we might be the only people left on Earth, remember this. If you must take the life, determine the morality of striking first. In other words, if you're good enough and willing to risk your life, then give your adversary a chance. But even if you are good enough, and more than your own fate hangs in the balance, don't risk sacrificing lives that may depend on yours to give a known enemy a so-called even break. Usually, if an enemy is worth killing, Your enemy's worth killing by whatever means necessary to achieve the preservation of your life or what other lives may depend on your success. So if you have to, shooting a man in the back is just about the same as shooting a man in the front. The important consideration is not that he deserves to die, usually, but that the event of his death will achieve the desired result. If the result is worth killing for to begin with, the direction from which the bullet or knife or whatever comes that ends his life is largely immaterial. You understand, Annie?
Annie didn't understand then, because in the videotapes of Western movies, the good guys never shot the bad guys when their backs were turned. But she came to understand decisions, determining which was better, a troubled conscience or wasting the lives of the good and the innocent. Decision made, Annie settled the laser-fitted pistol in her right fist. She sat back on her hind end, her legs apart, with her back propped against the snow-packed rock, her elbows rested just inside her thighs. She brought her left hand up, pulled back the hammer on the pistol, thumbed up the safety. She relaxed her shoulders, took control of her breathing. Annie could see both men through a niche of rock about 18 inches wide. The taller, brawnier of the two men was doing something with the canister. She moved her right thumb to just over the pad, the switch for the laser. She thumbed down the pistol safety. Then Annie wrapped her double-gloved left hand over her single-gloved right, around the front strap of the 9mm pistol. With her right thumb, she depressed the switch for the laser, and the red dot appeared between the shoulder blades of the man with the supposed explosive device. Annie blinked once, then touched her right first finger to the trigger. He was already pitched forward, as if she'd hit him with a vastly heavier caliber than 9mm. Either she'd hit him in the spine, or... The laser beam danced a zigzag pattern across the man's back and neck as she brought the gun down, swinging her entire body a few degrees right. Annie fired again as she settled the laser beam over the juncture of the second man's neck and shoulder. He was already turning toward the sound of the first shot as she fired. She fired once more on the second man as she brought the pistol down, the laser beam just below his thorax as his body spun away. She thought she'd hit high and off-center because of the speed with which his head was turning away from her, possibly striking him in the jaw. She swung the pistol toward the first man, but he was gone.
Damn it!
Annie moved the laser beam onto the second man again. His body was still, but she couldn't afford to leave him alive with the first one still in motion. She fired twice more into his thorax and head, killing him for certain. As she triggered the second shot, she realized her error. As she brought the pistol out of its mild recoil from that shot, she was already starting to move. Either she'd hit the first man in the spine, or...
Oh!
Whatever it was that hit her on the side of the head made Annie's entire body vibrate with the impact, and she sprawled right, barely holding onto the Taurus as she fell. And then there was tremendous pressure on her, and there was a knife beside her left eye.
I will make you ugly before I kill you.
Natalia threw herself into the snow at the sound of the first shot. The gusting wind made it hard to exactly peg the direction of the blast. The subsequent shots gave her bearings. They were clearly pistol shots, likely 9mm. Annie carried the laser-sighted Taurus from the arms lockers. Given the opportunity to take out both men spotted earlier on the microwave closed-circuit video monitors, Annie would take it. In all probability, she used the pistol. The helicopter was much louder now, likely homing in on an open radio frequency. The road leading up to the retreat became almost level for a short span, perhaps 500 yards away from the entrance. A skilled helicopter pilot could land there, even in the harsh conditions. But Annie would have been on the radio by now, announcing her success if she'd had any, or she would have called out by voice. Natalia received no radio transmission and heard no call.
I've waited long enough. Roush is still out there.
Natalia reached into the right side pocket of her parka, extracting the balisong. She wedged the knife in her gun belt. Swinging the M16 forward off her back, she clenched her right fist around the pistol grip, her right thumb poised over the selector for a split second. The helicopter would land within minutes or less. There was almost no time. She flicked the tumbler to auto. Then, with her right first finger just outside the trigger guard, she waded out of the snowdrift to find Annie and Friedrich Rausch.
You are the daughter, are you not?
Annie clearly recognized Rausch. Her eyes flickered from the point of his knife, less than an inch away from her left eye, to his face, and then back. His eyes were dark, gleaming pinpoints of light seen through his snow goggles.
I shot you.
I was bending over, and as luck would have it, good luck for me and bad for you. The bullet tore away part of my parka, but did not harm me at all. You are the daughter of Frau Rourke. You're the one who
fornicates with the subhuman.
Annie moved her right hand, still holding the gun. Roush almost drove the knife through her snow goggles and into her eye. She froze, not daring to even breathe. He kept the knife so close to her eye that it actually touched her snow goggles as he reached out with his left hand and took the Taurus from her grasp.
You are the Rook, daughter?
Yes.
And you chose to despoil your own body by...
Fuck off! Understand that in English?
He was going to kill her anyway.
My men will be here. They will not be happy. You have just cold-bloodedly murdered one of the top officials in the party.
I hoped to kill them all.
And if I blind you in both eyes and set you off somewhere in this icy wilderness to wander about in darkness and anguish and pain...
Better than your company.
How did you escape the mountain fortress of your father without being detected?
She had the distinct impression he hadn't seen Natalia. Annie fought to keep her expression fixed, not to show any relief even in her eyes.
I won't tell you.
We could blind you in one eye first. And of course my men are very lonely. If you will let this Jew lie with you.
You better kill me, because if you don't...
He stabbed the point of the knife through the left lens of Annie's snow goggles. Annie reached to her belt for the Detonic Scoremaster 45 to kill him.
Stop or I shoot!
Annie lay still, her left eye squinted tightly shut. She thought she could feel the tip of Roush's blade against the lid. Tears formed involuntarily in her eyes. The fingertips of her right hand were on the butt of the 45. She'd never make it. Roush smiled as Annie looked at him with her right eye.
Major Chimerovna, the communist agent, welcome.
Major, not anymore. Communist, not anymore either. Move and you will die.
I think not, Fraulein Major. If you do not move into my line of sight and carefully lay down your weapons, I drive the knife forward. Through her eye and into her brain. It is strong enough steel for that. And if you shoot me, I will fall toward her and you will have done my work for me.
Kill him!
Annie didn't move.
All right!
Annie wanted to shake her head in disbelief, to scream, to kill Roush herself. She didn't move. She could barely see Natalia edging around on Roush's left, lowering the muzzle of her M16.
Natalia!
I have no choice but to do what I must do, Annie!
Keep coming, Fraulein Major! Be quick about it!
Natalia moved through the drifted snow, letting the muzzle of the M16 all the way down.
Stop there!
Natalia stopped.
Drop to your knees, Fraulein Major!
Natalia dropped to her knees in the snow. Annie was too frightened to breathe.
Gently let the rifle fall to your side!
Natalia obeyed.
Now, easily. So there's no chance that I will have to kill the Jew lover yet. Unsling your weapons and let them fall beside you.
Natalia began to comply. Annie's body shook with cold and rage. Her head ached. Her muscles felt tied in knots. Out of the corner of her right eye, she could watch Natalia clearly.
Now the gun belt, and very slowly.
Natalia began to unbuckle it.
Fall back!
Annie threw her body weight back, her right eye never leaving Natalia's hands. Natalia's right hand flew outward to full extension of her arm and something gleaming left her fingertips. Annie saw the knife as it plunged into Roush's chest. Annie's gun was out. Annie ripped the snow goggles from her face. She opened her left eye. Natalia trudged forward, her gun belt over her left shoulder, her long gun still in the snow. Annie cried, angry with herself for it, but knowing it was a release of tension. She remembered the words of her father.
There were 8 people in the United States who could throw a Philippine balisong knife while closed and have it impact the target open. When Natalia arrived, that made 9.
Annie secured the dead Friedrich Rausch's snow goggles over her eyes.
Daddy would have enjoyed watching you, I think.
Don't make such a big thing out of my getting Roush. The circumstances were just right, that's all. Your father would have done it at least as well, if not better.
Thank you.
Friends never have to say that, but it is very nice when they do.
I think they may have placed an explosive device near the main entrance.
Natalia only nodded. Strapping on her gun belt, fetching up the sniper rifle and the Colt M16, Natalia joined Annie, running as fast as she could through the drifted snow toward the main entrance and the large rock before it. As Natalia bent over the metallic cylinder, Annie was beside her.
That's what I meant. It looks like...
It is.
There was a timer. Natalia examined it in as minute detail as circumstances allowed.
I can't disarm this. So we can either get as far away from here as possible in...
She looked away from the timer, turning to Annie.
We have 4 minutes and 16 seconds.
Or what?
We can give it back to the Nazis.
I'd have to deliver it in person, wouldn't I?
Annie smiled, the smile deceptively gentle when Natalia considered what her friend must be thinking.
All right.
Natalia double-checked the device, making as certain as she could that it was not rigged with some sort of gyroscopic contraption that would cause it to detonate when moved. In the end, it was a gamble, but she moved the metal cylinder, and the timer didn't instantly accelerate, nor did the device explode in her hands. They moved together through the snow along the side of the road, away from the retreat, looking for the first glimpse of the German gunship that would be bringing more of the Nazis. As they took cover, they saw it. The helicopter was touching down, skidding in almost elliptically toward the ground. Annie and Natalia crouched in the rocks together, waiting for touchdown.
When I open fire and draw them off toward me, you'll have about 30 seconds. Run out there and get the device as close to the gunship as you dare, then get to cover. You'll need a good 100 yards to be safe if we want to do it this way. More distance would be better, and you'll need cover.
The sound of gunfire and the accompanying muzzle flashes would certainly alert the occupants there was trouble in store. Natalia worked quickly with the Steyr-Mannlicher SSG before the enemy gunship took action she couldn't handle. Heavy swirling snow meant the SSG's 3x9 variable scope's objective lens would instantly cover. She flipped up the switch levers, both front and rear, on the base. The levers locked the base to the milled rails at the top of the receiver. She slid the entire assembly forward and off, handing it to Annie. Annie put the scope in one of the musette bags she wore. Then she picked up the bomb that lay between them in the snow. Nearly 2.5 minutes remained on the timer. Natalia watched Annie for a second longer, then brought the butt of the SSG to her right shoulder and squinted through the snow goggles along the simple iron sights. She speed-cocked a bolt, chambering the top round out of the 5-shot rotary magazine. The helicopter was down, men piled out. Natalia snapped off the set trigger, then rested her right first finger just beside the trigger guard.
Ready.
2 minutes left on the timer. I'm ready.
All right.
In the cold, crisp air, the sound of the 308 was an ear-splitting crack. The SSG rocked against her shoulder as one of the snow-smock-clad Nazi personnel took the hit and tumbled back into the chopper's fuselage. Natalia already had the bolt cocked. 3 men down, Natalia dropped the rifle in the snow.
Be ready!
Natalia ran along the side of the road away from the retreat, firing the M16 slung to her side, keeping to short bursts, just long enough to attract the attention of the men from the helicopter. Gunfire hammered into the rocks near her, furrowing the snow.